morning all, and welcome to this special seminar sponsored by the Center for the Study of Christian Origins. I've been asked to introduce our speaker, a longtime friend from at least the late 80s, Ben Witherington, who is a professor of the New Testament at Asbury Theological Seminary, and of course, mucho published author. Who not only started off writing on women in the New Testament before it was fashionable in his doctoral thesis and first books, but then subsequently, of course, numerous commentaries, works on theology of the New Testament, history of the New Testament. He has also written works for the wider kind of popular consumption, dealing with the various aspects of Christian theology, and because he gets bored with various other things. He occupies himself also as a joint author with his wife in writing a series of archaeological thrillers, which you can ask him about afterwards if you wish. The rest of us just sort of, you know, watch the television and read novels and dissolute lives, whereas he actually cannot find enough things to produce. But we're very glad to have him today. Of course, one of the things that he's done through numerous commentaries is to emphasize very much the rhetorical culture in which early Christianity emerged and in which New Testament writings, particularly the Pauline epistles, were composed. And today I think we're going to be hearing more along those lines. So you join me in welcoming We did the okay. I was supposed to let Helen make some notices, so nobody leaves until Helen makes a note.
Absolutely. The title of the lecture is Almost Thou Persuadest Me, The Importance of Greco-Roman Rhetoric for the Understanding of the Text and the Context of the New Testament. So rhetorical study of the New Testament is actually nothing new, whether we're talking about the rhetoric of the New Testament or the rhetoric in the New Testament. This kind of study is in fact not modern, though it was revived in the modern era by a landmark commentary in the Hermeneia series by Hans Dieter Betz on Galatians, and then the detailed work by George Kennedy at my alma mater at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, on New Testament and rhetoric. And then their disciples took the ball and ran from there. And more recently, we've had the works of Vernon Robbins doing something a little different. And what's happened over the last 30 years of this kind of work is a sort of division of labor into two parts, one of which is what I would call what Margaret Mitchell calls historical rhetorical criticism, which is asking the question, what kind of rhetoric were the writers of the New Testament using? So, not just interested in a rhetorical analysis of the New Testament, which you can do in various ways, but what about the rhetoric in the New Testament? Were the writers of the New Testament rhetorically adept? Had they had the education to be able to do that kind of thing? That's historical rhetorical criticism. That's the bailiwick I fall into, rather than sort of Vernon Robbins, let's read Lausberg, and anybody else who said anything on rhetoric, and sort of synthesize all of that and do a sort of modern rhetorical reading of the Bible. That's something rather different. Now, this lecture falls into two parts. As you use the rhetorical scheme, there is a refutatio of objections to this kind of reading, and then there's a probatio of the arguments for. And I have 12 pages of refutatio, so I'm not going to give you all of that. This lecture will be published. Can get it later, but I want to emphasize certain highlights. Because I think it would be good for me to dwell on the major objections to this kind of reading of the New Testament. Most of them fall into this heading. Perhaps your real issue with the analysis of the New Testament on the basis of Greco-Roman rhetoric comes from your analysis of the historical citizen labor of the earliest Christians. The argument goes something like this. Not many of the earliest Christians were among the social elites of society. This means that not many of them got what might be called a higher education. After all, none of the writers of the New Testament go around wearing Tarsus U or Edinburgh U t-shirts and are bragging about their educational pedigree and prowess. Since, ergo, they didn't have a higher education, they would not have known the full taxonomy of Greco-Roman rhetoric and would not have used it anyway, as they were mostly Jews drawing on the Old Testament for their polemics and arguments. That's kind of the way the argument usually goes. Now, I have to say, there are all sorts of historical problems with that kind of analysis of the social situation of the early Christians. I just want to make a few salient points against that. From a historical point of view, Hellenization, complete with language immersion and Greek culture, had influenced the entire biblical world, including Galilee and the Roman province of Judea, for many centuries by the time we get to the writings of the first New Testament documents. Martin Hingle demonstrated this a long time ago. I don't need to rehearse it all here. Just go read his Judaism and Hellenism, which is still a profitable read. He even demonstrated that there were schools of Greek rhetoric in Jerusalem in Paul's day. There is a good reason that the whole of the New Testament is written in Greek. It was the lingua franca of the Roman Empire, the language that most everybody knew some of, and knew they needed to know, just as today English is overwhelmingly the dominant language of the internet. Language is the gateway into a culture. It's the doorway into an education. In the New Testament, we have 27 books, all of which were originally written in Greek, or that would be my view, and all of which reflect not merely Greek diction, but Greek ideas, Greek culture, Greek influences of various sorts, including the influence of Greco-Roman rhetoric. Now, this in no means is meant to deny the obvious Jewish and Old Testament influences on the New Testament as well. To use a rhetorical trope, the hands are the hands of Virgil, but the voice is the voice of Jacob. Jacob, however, has learned some Greek ways along the way, though of course it's not all Greek to him. Second point about the historical analysis. The notion that early Christianity was led by a bunch of illiterate Jewish peasants is an historical myth. It may seem a pleasant fiction to Don Crossan and others, but it's a myth. Let's take one of the statements they almost always trot out from the New Testament, Acts 4.13. The statement in Acts 4.13 is not claiming that Peter and John were illiterate. The Greek is agrammatoi kai idiotai, which does not mean they were illiterate idiots. It means that they were not insiders. Now, there's a very fine recent publication by Paul Trabilko, which I would commend to all of you, Self-Designations and Group Identity in the New Testament, CUP publication last year, in which he points out that the way the word idiotes, idiotai, is used is to distinguish an insider from an outsider. An idiotai, for example, in 1 Corinthians 14, is somebody who is not an insider in the community, comes in from outside of the community, and Paul is concerned about a person like that not understanding prophecy and tongues and all of that sort of stuff in 1 Corinthians 14. What Acts 4:13 means is, these folks from Galilee didn't come get their education here in Jerusalem. They are not learned, nor are they insiders. Neither of those critiques mean they were illiterate peasants. What it does mean is we're seeing here the sort of typical snobbery of the Jerusalem elites. I take seriously the fact that Papias tells us that there were some early Christians, early followers of Jesus, like Peter, who preferred to teach in Aramaic, and that Mark had to render some of his teachings into Greek in his gospel. I think that may well be so. Perhaps some of the earliest preaching, especially in the Holy Land, was in Aramaic, and it was later rendered into Greek. But most of the documents in the New Testament are collaborative efforts, and many of them involve scribes, amanuenses. And once you get into that territory, almost anything is possible. For example, I would say it's probably the Silvanus was of help to the author of 1 Peter, which explains why we have Greco-Roman rhetoric in detail in 1 Peter. So it's not enough to ask the question, Did the source of this information have a rhetorical education? You have to also ask, did the persons who put this document into Greek have a rhetorical education? You need to ask both of those questions. Third point, in regard to ancient education in Greek anyway, there were schools and teachers of rhetoric all over the empire. Let me just give you a list from Galilee of famous people who got a rhetorical education in Galilee. Josephus the historian, Theodorus the rhetorician, Meleager the poet, Philodemus the philosopher, they all came from Galilee and they got their educational training in the Holy Land, Galilee and Jerusalem. When we're talking about education, however, in antiquity, we're not talking about professors or even lecturers, or even instructors. You're talking about the grammatus, you're talking about the philosopher, and you're talking about the rhetor. They were the basic teachers in Greco-Roman contexts and even in Jewish contexts. It's those sorts of folks who did their job, plowed their furrow, all over the Greco-Roman world, including the Holy Land itself. So my point is this. No significant place in the Roman Empire had escaped the influence of Hellenization, Greek culture, and rhetoric. This includes Galilee and Samaria. One more example. Justin Mortar, born perhaps a bit before 100, at Flavius Neapolis, ancient Shechem, modern Nablus, in Samaria. Of Greek parents, he was brought up with a good education in rhetoric, poetry, and history. Where did he get this? Samaria and Galilee. So Mark Pingel put this way. Judea, Samaria, and Galilee were bilingual, or better, trilingual areas. While Aramaic was the vernacular of ordinary people, and Hebrew the sacred language of religious worship and of scribal discussion, Greek had largely been established as the linguistic medium for trade, commerce, and administration. Just so. It was also the language for those who wanted to get ahead in life through close association with the elites, such as the Herods or even the temple elites in Jerusalem. Fourth point, rhetorical education began at what we would call the primary school level. Now I'm going to use American terminology, so I'm just trusting you understand primary, secondary, tertiary level. If you read George Kennedy Mileager's book, The Progymnasmata, published by Esdaile in 2003, or if you read Ron Hawk and Ed O'Neill's book, The Crya and Ancient Rhetoric, Esdaile published in 2002, what they are both able to show is that the training in rhetoric begins at the elementary level. Ergo, you didn't need to have a higher education to know some Greco-Roman rhetoric. I mean, look at the exercises in the Progymnasmata. You learn how to write a speech. You learn how to compose a letter in rhetorical form using the elaborate device called prosopopoia. This is elementary education. And why? It's because these cultures were largely not cultures of texts. They were oral cultures. Oral was dominant, written was subdominant. And the texts that we have in the New Testament are oral texts. No, that's not an oxymoron like Microsoft Works. They were meant to be heard. These are texts that were meant to be heard. They have alliteration, assonance, rhythm, rhyme, and yea, verily, rhetoric. Furthermore, rhetoric had been taught at the elementary level since the time of Aristotle, for hundreds of years. When did letter writing teaching begin? First of all, it began in a rhetorical context. And secondly, the later schools of letter writing do not date to before the first century AD. In other words, training to rhetoric was primary, training in epistolary writing was secondary and later. So whether we're dealing with Pseudo-Libanius or some of these others that provided these epistolary handbooks of this is how you write a friendly letter, this is how you write an ambassadorial letter. In fact, that practice was waxing in the first century AD, but it was way, miles, centuries behind training in rhetoric. This is why we have letters in antiquity that have a prescript and have a postscript, but everything in between conforms to rhetorical conventions, not later epistolary conventions. For example, Pliny's epistle 111 or 2:6, or Seneca's Epistula Moralis 13 through 15, if you look carefully at these are not letters. These are basically discourses with epistolary sprinkles. That's what they are. They are discourses, diatribes, essays, call them what you like. They are not like ancient letters. Here's a typical AD 50 papyrus letter. Stoedius to his own mysterium, greetings. Hope you are well. I have sent you Blastus to collect the forked sticks for the vineyard. See that he does not loiter, volley. That's it. This is an ancient business-like letter. And you open the letters of Paul, as John Donne said, you hear thunder, a thunder that rolls throughout the earth, because what you have is arguments, discourse, not merely epistolary features. Now, I could go through a long diatribe demonstrating to you how letters that appear to be letters at the beginning or at the end, in between, look like rhetorical discourses. But this has been demonstrated by classic professors like J. A. Goldstein in regard to Demosthenes. There are plenty of forensic speeches that have epistolary frameworks. Basil's consolatory rhetoric, Epistle 5, of the Church Father, Epistle 6, is not really a letter. It has an epistolary beginning and ending, but otherwise it's actually an epigraphic discourse. Epistolary frameworks were used for all kinds of ancient documents. For example, Epictetus, Diatribe 1:1, starts, Arian to his friend Lucius Gellius, greetings. And then, the only thing you have in this document is a discourse. It's not really mainly a letter. Or, 2 Maccabees 1:1-6, epistolary prescript, and then a historical work. Or, what about Cicero, writing to his friend Atticus, says, quote, your literis, letters, lighten my care, and when absent too often, you afforded me great solace, for it's your letters that first restored my spirits. When you actually read these documents, they are treatises dedicated to Cicero with an epistolary beginning. That's what they are. Long and short of it, there were epistolary features to many documents that were not, in essence, ancient letters. They were often discourses, diatribes, and essays. Fifth rebuttal to the suggestion that Greco-Roman rhetoric is not essential to the reading of the New Testament as a historical subject. Duane Whitfin said a long time ago that the Roman Empire was a rhetoric-saturated realm. It was in the education, it was in the public speeches, it was in the inscriptions, it was in the imperial propaganda, we could go on. Litvin stressed, rightly, that most of the Greek-speaking persons in the empire were either producers or avid consumers of rhetoric. There were even rhetoric and poetry contests at the athletic games throughout the empire. Famous case of Nero going to the poetry contest in Carthage and winning. A shock. Rhetoric was a spectator sport. It was entertainment before Xbox, TVs, and movies. People would go to the Agora and Forum to watch speakers speak. They would go to trials to hear lawyers argue. If early Christianity really was an evangelistic religion, wanting to persuade a Greek-speaking world about the odd notion that a crucified manual worker from Nazareth rose from the dead and was king of kings and lord of lords, this was going to take some persuasion. And the chief tool in the arsenal of all well-known persuaders was Greco-Roman rhetoric. This was especially so if, as seems likely, the Christian evangelists like Paul had an urban strategy. That is, they were seeking to begin evangelism in the major cities of the empire which is to say the very places where education and rhetoric were most in evidence in the empire. Now, I'm not going to rattle on about the case that Edmund Judge has made over and over again, that the Christian movement was led by a strata of society that was more socially elite than perhaps the majority of Christians were. Our concern is, who produced these documents? 27 documents is a heck of a lot of documents to have from a new religious movement that began in the first century AD. Who produced the documents? Edwin Judge's case is it's the more socially elite members, perhaps with the help of scribes, who produced these documents, which explains why it is that indeed they reflect Greco-Roman rhetoric. One of the usual objections to the thesis that I am plowing here is, why is it that somebody like Luke in Acts says absolutely nothing about Paul being the letter writer? Well, that sort of question, I think, puts the emphasis on the wrong syllable, because it forgets that this is primarily an oral culture in which writing serves the purposes of orality. Paul's letters are what he would say if he was present, but he's absent. So it's a discourse sent from afar, which one of his co-workers will read out dramatically and answer questions about when they get there. The reason Luke, in Acts, does not say anything about Paul being a letter writer is because that was an entirely secondary and surrogate means of communication, even for Paul in the first century AD. Indeed, letters were used to convey the messages Paul would have spoken directly to his converts if he could have been there. I want to read you a quote from Chrysostom. He says, "Some adults have experience with texts, others do not. To the latter, a document is just parchment and ink and a continuous flow of incomprehensible Greek letters, not a means by which the living voice of an absent friend can be known." I really like that quote. That's great. They were looking for the living voice. It's the living voice that's primary. Text were supports to the living voice. Now, I could go on dealing with this particular issue. I want to commend a book to you that Larry and I both like. It's William Johnson's book, Readers and Reading Culture in the High Roman Empire. Honestly, I think this should be required reading for all students of the New Testament letters. What it shows is that if we were to talk about the book trade, it was just beginning to grow up in the first century AD. It largely served the elites of Rome in particular and the wealthy of the empire, not ordinary people. Now, when you contrast that with the fact that the 27 letters of the New Testament are not written to social elites mostly, they're written to various Christian groups around the empire. Here we're talking about a very different kind of document, aren't we? And so the insights from that are helpful. One more point along this line. If you read Revelation 1, 1 through 4, one of the interesting things that you find there is a distinction between the reader, singular in the Greek, of what John of Patmos has now said in his visions, and then the hearers. The reader is the lecturer who is presenting the revelation that John had to Ephesus and these other churches. The hearers are a separate group who are learning from hearing the lector read it out. I think that's exactly the same thing that's going on in Mark 13 when it says, "Let the reader, singular, understand." This is a footnote to the person who is orally presenting Mark, and in this case Mark 13, "You might better explain abomination of desolation to the audience, otherwise they are so not getting it." The reader is not just anybody who could read a text. The reader is the official proclaimer of the text for the hearers. The last major objection that usually comes from even opposing that Paul used Greco-Roman rhetoric comes from a particular kind of reading of 1 Corinthians 1, where Paul says he's not going to use lofty words of wisdom, but foolishness of preaching to convict, convince, and convert persons in Corinth. In his long monograph and helpful, Are Paul and Philo Amongst the Sophists, Bruce Winter shows at length that this is a typical rhetorical trope to distinguish between sophistic rhetoric and ordinary substantive rhetoric. Sophistic rhetoric is full of sound and purity, but signifying not much. Its emphasis is on the art of eloquence, not substantive communication. What Paul is saying is, I didn't come to Corinth like a sophist, full of flowery language. What he's not doing is saying, I eschewed the use of rhetoric when I came your way. This is what Margaret Mitchell says about that passage. Our wordsmith Paul would recast his initial visit using the customary rhetorical topos, no real wizard with words, indeed like Demosthenes, marbles in his mouth, trembling in his sandals, and out of his natural element. And yet, despite this anti-sophistic rhetoric, it is inescapably a verbal proclamation in rhetorical form, a logos and charisma that Paul is offering in 1 Corinthians. In short, Paul is using rhetoric to refute the notion that he was a purveyor of mere verbal eloquence. Nothing else. All right, I'm going to press on now to my positive case and present you with that at this point. A few more reminders about ancient education. Firstly, there are now numerous studies about education in the biblical world that make clear, beyond reasonable doubt, that rhetoric was indeed an essential part of education at all three levels, all over the empire. I think this can't really be debated if we're talking about Greek education. The two staples of it would be Greek philosophy, grammar, of course, and rhetoric. These would be the three staples of that kind of education. It is true enough that by the time we get past the New Testament era into the 2nd and 3rd and 4th centuries, we begin to have letter-writing handbooks by Pseudo-Albanius. Absolutely, we do. But notice, however, that letter writing is not yet a staple broadly used part of any education in the empire during the time when these New Testament documents were being written. It was a discipline in the process of being developed. Now, the chief help that knowing about ancient letter writing gives us in analyzing the New Testament is in discussing the epistolary prescripts, readings, and postscripts of the New Testament letter. Basically, that's it. So far as I can see, there was no epistolary convention to offer a thanksgiving prayer or a blessing prayer at the beginning of an ancient letter. There was a health wish, hope you're well, one-liner, throwaway line, end of the story. This is not a prayer report. This is not a thanksgiving either. It's certainly not a three chapters long thanksgiving like we have in 1 Thessalonians. Health wish, not the same as a prayer report or a Pauline thanksgiving. And as for the amazing range of arguments that show up in the Pauline corpus and in Hebrews and in 1 Peter and elsewhere in the New Testament letters after the opening pleasantries, epistolary conventions help us not at all. Now, when I was taught epistolary analysis back at the dawn of time when the earth was still cooling, B.C., before cell phones, B.C., before computers, when I was taught that stuff, we were told that that gigantic chunk of stuff in the middle was called the body middle. This is a formal distinction without substance and with no ancient reference at all. It tells us nothing about what is in the middle of this document. It tells us absolutely nothing about the form or the content of 90% of these documents. In other words, we get little or no help in analyzing the bulk of the material in New Testament letters on the basis of either ancient or modern epistolary discussion. It's striking to me that even those phrases that I were taught
were little signals from the epistolary handbooks that there would be a transition or a new topic would be arise. You can find all of them in Quintilian. They're all right there. For example, now I want you to know, Quintilian says in 4:2:22 in his Institutes of Oration, classic way to introduce a new topic. Or, I appeal to you, friends. Another classic way to introduce a new topic. Or, now concerning. Right? Peri dem. This is not an epistolary form in the first place. Quintilian, Aristotle, Cicero, they all knew this from the rhetorical handbooks, not from some epistolary handbook. One of the things we have to do from time to time is unlearn some things in light of further evidence. We need to unlearn some of the things we were told were true about New Testament letters in form, critical studies, and manuals, and books, and monographs. We need to unlearn them because the New Testament writers, frankly, didn't read Debelius or Bultmann or various other form critics of our day. We need to unlearn them because they are anachronistic. They are reading into the text something that wasn't in the text in the first century AD. And if you're interested in historical rhetorical criticism, anachronism is anathema. It's not a good thing. The documents we have in the New Testament were primarily meant to be heard, not to be studied as we studied them as written texts. They were indeed oral texts. Now, one more point about this, and Twain Watson has said a lot about this. I'll give you a quote from him in a minute. The finding of gigantic chiasms in the letters of the New Testament simply doesn't work if these are oral documents. Why not? Big chiasms have to be seen. The letters have to be studied to make this out. You can't pick them out by listening to a linear reading out of the document. A tight ABBA structure over the course of a few verses? Fine. The ear can pick that up. But the kind of analysis you get, for example, in Ken Bailey's recent Paul Through Mediterranean Eyes, forget it. A chiasm over 8 chapters of a letter of Paul, the hearers of this document would go, don't get that burn. No. Did you hear a chiasm there? I don't think so. Right? Listen to what Dwayne Watson says about chiasms. Quote, the chiasm has rightly been seen as structuring individual verses and small blocks of text. However, I doubt that chiasm structures entire Pauline epistles, as has been argued, for example, for Philippians, especially if it is concluded that Greco-Roman conventions have played a significant role in this construction. Greco-Roman rhetoric did not discuss chiasms, and certainly not as an organizing principle of larger works. Besides, the conventions in play for invention and arrangement make chiasm a very difficult form of arrangement to maintain. Greco-Roman rhetoric, as it is incorporated into a speech or a document, is based on a linear unfolding of a series of topics and propositions guided by the exigencies of a rhetorical situation. This approach makes a chiastic arrangement for an entire epistle or a large chunk of a large epistle not only extremely difficult, but extremely unlikely. Exactly right. But we could have come to the same conclusion simply on the basis that these are oral and aural discourses, meant to be heard by all, not primarily meant to be read, except by the lector and a few well-educated literate Christians in the audience. These were oral texts that had, in the first instance, to be read out loud to make sense of where thoughts and sentences and rhetorical units started and stopped. Now, I'm trusting you know that, yea, verily, there were no chapters and verses in these documents originally. Archbishop Langton of Canterbury, who had way too much time on his hands, provided us with those, and many of them are implicitous, never mind not inspired. I get particularly irked with the break between Hebrews 11 and Hebrews 12, but you could name many such instances. These documents were meant to be orally delivered. And when I say delivered, I don't merely mean hand it over to the audience and let them ponder it. I mean a co-worker of Paul or Peter or whoever else would have had a lector or co-worker who would already know the contents of these documents, would come and deliver them in an appropriate way, and then perhaps respond to questions about them. I was saying to Larry just the other day, this may explain the throwaway comment in 1 Corinthians 14, where Paul says, if these women have any questions to ask, let them ask at home. There was an expectation that they could ask questions about the prophecies during the service itself. In other words, early church was not like attending the first church of the Frigidaire, where you have a formal presentation to which the audience nods knowingly but does not respond and then shakes hands as you leave. This is not how the early church functioned. It was more an interactive environment. It helped, if you're an ancient listener who knows anything about rhetoric, if a document was composed on the basis of a basic structure of Greek speech, which was exordium, narratio, propositio, probatio, refutatio, peroratio, initial salvo, narration of relevant facts, thesis statement, arguments for, arguments against, and a peroration. It helped because people all over the empire already knew this basic Greek speech structure. They knew how to listen for the thesis statement, listen for the final summing up, brace themselves for the sturm und drang of a peroration like we find in Ephesians 6. I like to have my students read Ephesians 6, 10, and following while playing Wagner's Die Walküre in the background. Dun, 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 dun. And yes, the function of a peroration was to stir the deeper emotions. You've already engaged the more surface emotions in the exordium, and then you have these emotion-infused arguments along the way. By the way, the Greek word for arguments in the rhetorical context was pistoi, proofs, arguments. Very interesting. Now, our problem is that we have studied these New Testament documents as if they were indeed like modern texts. We studied them in the first instance primarily in English, and yet a third of the rhetorical force of the Greek discourse is lost in translation. Assonance, alliteration, rhythm, rhyme, sequence, a host of other oral and oral effects. The recent detailed studies about how ancient manuscripts were composed, see Professor Hurtado, Professor Gamble, Professor Johnson, and how the book trade arose, and what the characteristics were of an ancient oral culture where literacy at best was only 20%, has been outlined well in recent monographs. So, I will simply say, the New Testament is full of oral texts. Since the proof of the pudding is in the eating, it's now time, as I begin to draw to a close, to demonstrate not just micro-rhetoric. One of the canards that often happens in this discussion is, okay, there are rhetorical questions. There are small rhetorical devices in Paul's letters and the Hebrews and here, there, and yonder. Micro-rhetoric, fair enough. Macro-rhetoric with large argument structures and thesis statements, not so much. To that kind of rebuttal, this is targeted. Let's start with the issue of ethos, logos, and pathos. Any good rhetorical discourse worth its salt is going to address, at the beginning, ethos, in the middle, logos, and at the end, pathos. Ethos is the establishing of rapport with your audience. We would call it the sucking up, right? It's also the establishing of the authority of the speaker. Now, how, for example, if you live in Pedro, this is Paul, do that. He establishes his authority in the epistolary prescript. Paul, an apostle for Jesus Christ. Right there, there's an authority statement made from the outset. And then you have the sucking up. Even in a problem-solving letter like 1 Corinthians, you have the sucking up. I always thank God in all my prayers for all you Corinthians and your wonderful spiritual gifts. Never mind that in 1 Corinthians 12:3-14, he's going to lambaste them for the way they use their spiritual gifts. No, you've got to establish rapport with the audience even if you're royally ticked off with them. Early on, you need to make them favorably disposed to listen to the rest of the discourse. The only time Paul doesn't do this is in Galatians, because he couldn't think of anything nice to say. I mean, he was really right royally ticked off, and so he skips a nice little Thanksgiving prayer and sucking up and just goes right to, oh, you idiot Galatians, right? Otherwise, the attending to ethos is critical. Make the audience favorably disposed to hear you. Then you offer the lowboy, the arguments, the proofs, and then you make the emotional appeal at the end to get them to bond with you and with your message and embrace it, and so that you will at the end say, Paul is just special. I love his arguments. He's so right. Let's say the amen. And that's the end of the discourse, right? Ethos, logos, pathos, that's how it's supposed to work. And that is how it works with Paul's letters in Hebrews, in 1 Peter, and elsewhere in the New Testament. A few more points of elucidation are crucial. Firstly, as scholars have often noticed, for reasons they did not fully grasp, Pauline's opening prayers often uses them as a preview of coming attractions. This is not an epistolary convention. Use a prayer as a preview of coming attractions. You will not find this in the epistolary handbooks. But, oh boy, you will find it in the rhetorical handbooks. Foreshadowed for them, either in the exordium or the narratio of what is yet to come. It's all over the rhetorical handbooks. Paul is following this quite nicely at the beginning of almost all his discourses. It was a rhetorical convention he was following. And then there is the matter of the thesis statement. I like to tell my students, if you can find the thesis statement of a Pauline discourse, you've got Paul by the short hairs. You know what these arguments are going to be arguing for. You know where this discourse, however many turgid arguments there are in a row, is going to be about. It's not a random series of arguments. It's a carefully sequenced series of arguments. And the thesis statement and the peroration on either end as brackets will help you get what the substance of it is. For example, Romans 1, 16 and 17. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for the gospel is the good news of Jesus Christ for the Jew first and also for the Greek. And then he goes on to say that the discourse is going to be about the righteousness of God and the setting right of human beings. And then he quotes Habakkuk, doesn't he? Where he says, the righteous shall live by faith. That would be one translation. He's given you the thesis statement, and lo and behold, guess what happens in the next 15 chapters of Romans? He rings the changes on dikaiosune, dikaiao, dikaios, and all variants of that whole cognate word group. Why? Because this is what Romans is in fact about. The righteousness of God is setting right of human beings. Now, one thing about that, We have mostly deliberative rhetoric. We're arguing the case for behavior to change in the near future. We do have some epideictic rhetoric in the New Testament as well, and you didn't have a thesis statement for an encomium or a funeral address. So in the case of dealing with something like 1 Corinthians 13, which is a nice little epideictic interlude in 1 Corinthians, or even Hebrews as a whole discourse, or Ephesians, that's epideictic rhetoric, and there's a reason it doesn't have a thesis statement. You don't have a proposition that you're arguing for in that kind of rhetoric. The vast majority of the rhetoric in the New Testament is deliberative. There's some forensic, there's some epideictic. But mostly, the authors of the New Testament are arguing for a verdict. They want you to change your belief, or your behavior, or your praxis, or all three in the near future. And this letter is meant to help them, help you accomplish that. One more point on this, and then I'll bring myself to a conclusion. One of the reasons
that some of the latter callings have been misread and misunderstood is because they do indeed reflect a different style, a different grammar, in some cases some different vocabulary along the way. In this case, I'm talking about Colossians and Ephesians. We could have avoided a lot of long and lugubrious arguments about how those two letters couldn't possibly be by Paul because they sound different and have different sentence structures and use different vocabulary and so on and on, had someone bothered to pay attention to the fact that these letters were written according to the style of Asiatic rhetoric, the most verbose and hyperbolic form of first century rhetoric. 26 line long sentences? No problem for Asiatic rhetoric. This is what the people of the province of Asia apparently were enamored with. Cicero was trained in this very form of rhetoric. He went to Rhodes to learn Asiatic rhetoric, and if there was ever a long-winded prosecutor, it was Cicero, Asiatic-length rhetoric popular in Rome. It's not an accident that these documents were addressed to congregations somewhere in or near the province of Asia, and they reflect the style and the rhetorical substance of Asiatic rhetoric. A skillful rhetorician, as Luke Timothy Johnson has said, was able to vary his style according to the audience. And he does so in Colossians and Ephesians. I think the argument from style and vocabulary is entirely specious as a basis for concluding that Colossians and Ephesians couldn't be by Paul. There may be other good reasons for drawing that conclusion, but those are not them. It's not a matter of different authors. It's a matter of flexibility in Greek style and rhetoric. Just how well some of the New Testament writers knew Greco-Roman rhetoric has been demonstrated at length in regard to Hebrews, various of Pauline letters, 1 Peter, various other documents. So, all that by way of saying, I think that the case for a Greco-Roman reading of the New Testament and not just micro-rhetoric, but maximum rhetoric, macro-rhetoric as well, is important to the study of the New Testament. So here's my conclusion. What I have sought to show in this lecture, and I'm tempted to give you the ending of the book of Hebrews, I have spoken to you briefly about these matters, is that one ignores Greco-Roman rhetoric at one's peril if one wants to understand the New Testament. It's not enough to have a nodding acquaintance with minor rhetorical devices and how they work, and say the negative rhetorical questions, for example, at the end of 1 Corinthians 12, tell us what Paul does not think. Not all speak in tongues, do they? Not all prophesy, do they? If you know rhetoric, you'll know that any double negative question that begins with may can't possibly be answered yes. It has to be answered no. Pentecostals pay attention here. Not all speak in tongues, do they? Okay. If you want to understand how Paul's argument works, why he appeals to what he does, first to experience, then to Scripture, then to Testament traditions in Galatians 3 or 1 Corinthians 11, why the arguments are arranged so you have arguments for first and then refutations later in Paul's letters, why there is so much amplification and redundancy in 1 John, or why there is so little future eschatology in Ephesians. Well, it's epideictic rhetoric. You focus on the present, not the future. Or why the pastoral epistles have enthymemes right, left, and center, and are not examples of disjointed ethical snippets, as Debelli has put it. Or why the so-called pronouncement stories in Mark are really classic rhetorical crying, as Papias agreed. Or why Luke's prologue in Luke 1 through 4 takes the form it does. Or why the speeches in Acts all take rhetorical form in summary. Or why synecdoche's comparison is used so eloquently and powerfully in Hebrews. If you want to understand any of that, you need to understand Greco-Roman rhetoric and give it its due. In Paul's famous rhetorical tour de force speech in Acts 26, given before Agrippa and Festus,
There comes a juncture where Festus interrupts and exclaims, "You are out of your mind, your idiotes. Too much learning is driving you insane, Paul." I thank you for not interrupting this brief lecture with that interjection. In closing, I rather hope instead you would say to me, "Almost thou persuadest me to become a rhetorician."